So thanks a lot for having me. So I'm going to be talking about this work with Matt Cleveland that came out in March. And I'm going to be needing some ideas about where this should go next. So I'm really hoping that this will be, that I'll come away from this conference with some new ideas of where to go with this. So the picture I'm going to be trying to describe is eternal inflation, which was discussed by Vilenkin and Garriga and Don Page yesterday. So some sort of initial conditions, which then get washed out by this evolution, where bubbles of different types form, different things happen. Bubbles are just the easiest thing to draw. And the late time behavior is characterized by some kind of attractor regime of eternal inflation. So it's a very big universe in which the predictions for observable quantities like cosmological constant, the CMB, et cetera, are necessarily statistical because different people are observing different things in different places. Okay, that's the picture that I'm going to be working in. Normally I would describe it a little more, but after the conference yesterday, I'll just leave it at that. That's the picture of the universe that I want to be trying to describe. Okay, now there are two problems with this picture, which hopefully are related to each other. Number one is that if you just plunge ahead and start computing the number of observations of one cosmological constant compared to another. So if you just start computing using some semi-classical description, which seems to be good locally, you find infinities. Okay, because the volume just continues increasing with time. And so unless you cut things off, everything happens an infinite number of times. This happens in a regime where locally the energy densities don't need to be particularly high. Nothing exotic needs to be happening locally. A hopefully related confusion is the question of how do we rigorously understand, or anyway, more rigorously understand quantum gravity by which I mean string theory, how to rigorously understand really any theory of quantum gravity, though, in this inflating background. Maybe in this background is the wrong way of saying it. How do we understand this kind of solution to quantum gravity in a rigorous way? So, for example, in string theory, likes to compute, the place where string theory is rigorously defined, it computes the S matrix in flat space. Okay, because of the diffeomorphism invariance, it doesn't compute local correlation functions. What it computes is the S matrix. That's the quantity that's well defined. Or let's say that string theory is defined by the boundary CFT correlation functions in anti-de Sitter space. Again, this is a situation where we can take a limit where we have kind of a non-gravitating boundary, which is infinitely far away. So here's ADS, we have this cylinder, and even though I'm drawing it being finite, this distance is infinite, and the geometry of the boundary doesn't fluctuate. Similarly, in Minkowski space, if you have a finite amount of energy, everything dissipates into asymptotic, well-separated particles here, and again, the boundary geometry doesn't fluctuate. So these are the things that we know how to understand rigorously in string theory. And it's just clear that this doesn't fit, this kind of solution doesn't fit into that category. In fact, you can prove along the lines of Guth and Farhi that if you have Minkowski asymptotics, you can't create an internally inflating region of the spacetime unless it's hidden behind the horizon. Okay, so these kind of usual tools, this is maybe worth writing down. So these tools are not obviously not helpful in any obvious way for eternal inflation. Because of basically these Guth-Farhi theorems, that if you start with ADS or Minkowski asymptotics, eternal inflation is hidden behind horizons. And the reason I say hopefully these are related is that we would all like it to be true that once we understand this solution more rigorously, then it'll just be clear what quantities to compute. And we won't have to argue about, you know, how to cut things off, how to take ratios, et cetera. Okay, so the question is, how do we rigorously understand this solution? Now, one possibility
A couple of things can come out of this. One thing that could come out of this would be a rigorous understanding of the solution. The other would be an understanding that this is not going to happen. And so this is the wrong question. These infinities are the wrong question. Either way, it would tell us that this is not the right. This question, this problem we thought we had something classically was not actually a problem. But yeah, I have to say there aren't really hints of either of those things happening so far. But we haven't solved this problem yet. Okay, so let me briefly mention that one possibility for defining things which string theory might like to compute is more of an aside, is to focus on these lambda equals zero. Focus on what Lenny likes to call hats, these lambda equals zero bubbles, where locally the asymptotics are similar to Minkowski space. Okay, it's not globally like Minkowski space, but locally all of the energy dissipates, and the asymptotics are like Minkowski space. So you might think that locally something like an S matrix makes sense. So this is something that Lenny Susskind and I looked at. And then in studying this a little more with Sakino and Ye, we stumbled into some intriguing evidence that there might be a conformal field theory which lives on the boundary of this bubble, which is an S2, which would again be a description of the physics inside this bubble. And that's one thing which is incorporated into this CFT of CFTs, which Alex and Jaume were discussing yesterday. So that's one possible direction, is to focus on these hats, and then to say that perhaps that encodes all of the information about what's going on in eternal inflation. Today I'm going to take, so one possibility is to try to understand eternal inflation just from the asymptotic data up here. So I think this is an interesting possibility. I've worked on this possibility, and it might still be the right idea. But if that's the case, you are going to have to understand, before we understand how to resolve these infinities, how somebody over here is represented in this data here. So it would be a rather difficult representation of, say, us. Okay, how does the data about us get into these lambda equals zero regions?
So it might be the right idea, but if so, it's going to be difficult to make progress. So let me today. So that's one possibility. But the possibility that I'm going to consider today is something basically the same idea which Vilenkin and Garriga were discussing yesterday, that there's some kind of CFT which lives on entire future infinity. Okay? So let me assume for today that the thing that string theory wants to compute, the analog of the boundary CFT in ADS, or the S matrix in Minkowski space, let's assume that the right quantity to focus on here, the well-defined quantity, let's assume that that is some kind of CFT, perhaps an exotic CFT, perhaps even with some sort of gravity. Let's assume that the well-defined quantity is some kind of CFT, which lives on future infinity. That's right. This would be a Euclidean CFT. No, it's that's also Euclidean. This boundary theory lives on these S2s here, which are Euclidean. So this is all Euclidean here. But yeah, that's a good point. So here's a 2D CFT, Euclidean CFT living on an S2. And right, so this is what we're focusing on here is some kind of thing which lives here, a 3D CFT, which is still Euclidean, which lives there. Okay. That's right. Yeah. So, yes? Right. Well, this 2D CFT we discussed, we were discussing something which we thought would be an actual CFT. And coupling to a Liouville field, still people would normally call that an actual CFT. This theory, I think it's much less clear what it's going to be. For my purposes today, that's exactly what I want to look at. So let me explain where I'm going with this now. Okay. So as Alex and John discussed yesterday, there's some complications with the CFT. There's this inner pieces of infinity. There's these ADS bubbles. There's these Minkowski bubbles, and this thing gets very complicated very quickly. So what I want to do today is sort of complementary to what was being discussed yesterday about how all of these big pieces might fit together. What I want to do is I want to focus on the simplest possible example of this thing. And I want to look at the correlation functions. And I want to ask if those correlation functions are a thing which is sort of like a CFT or an actual CFT, or what they are. Okay? And so I'm going to focus on a very simple example where we can actually just compute up to the four-point function. And let's just see what those things look like. Well, the idea would be that the CFT is a dual description of the bulk dynamics, just like it is in ADS. So all of the same information about the bulk should be there in the boundary theory. And as in ADS CFT, some things might be more convenient to compute in certain regimes on either side, but right, in principle, this would be a... I think the initial surface, I think that's a bit of a, well, so it'll be clear what I'm assuming in this model. I think the initial surface is a bit of a red herring in that in the CFT description of that would roughly be that, that you've turned on some sort of irrelevant operator in the CFT, which is perhaps still, which is perhaps not relevant to computing certain observables. Okay, but we can talk about that. It'll be very clear what I'm assuming here about the. Well, I'll comment on that as we go. I'm going to, well, so yeah, maybe I should say right now. So let me draw my model first of all. So here's my model. I have some kind of potential, and this is one place where drawing this on the blackboard is a little bit dangerous, but okay. This is supposed to be a periodic potential. It doesn't have to be a sine wave, but I'm going to assume this is a periodic potential. So we just have a bunch of identical vacua. These vacua have the same vacuum energy, the same everything. Okay, so there's a discrete shift symmetry. There's a discrete shift symmetry, which is phi goes to phi plus a constant. Yeah, there's going to be tunneling. So the vacuum energy here is positive. So there's going to be tunneling here. Okay. So this is the model. It's kind of the simplest landscape, just a bunch of degenerate vacua. Okay. If you were doing ordinary quantum mechanics, that would be correct. In De Sitter space, it's a little bit different because, you know, because of the expansion, you have the instantons which make transitions locally. You do, regardless of what you call the ground state, you do have instantons, which are local quantities. This is the potential, so the minimum is positive. This is a field theory coupled to gravity. This is a field theory coupled to gravity with zero cosmological constant. So since the minimum of V is positive, the solution will be De Sitter. Okay.
But there'll be a single De Sitter invariant
back. That's right.
So I mean it's not such that a back one
Well, look. Why don't I tell you what I think the dynamics looks like, and then you can see if you disagree or not. Okay. It's certainly true in quantum mechanics. You would just have some mixture as being ground state. Okay. So what does the dynamics look like here? So we have the De Sitter space here. And from time to time, bubbles nucleate. I'm going to talk about the initial conditions. I'm about to describe the initial conditions. Okay.
At one of the minima, then it's De Sitter.
So the solution I'm going to focus on here.
Okay.
Is a solution. Which has the maximal symmetry that you could have in this potential. That symmetry is SO41. So this is some, well, so let me say one additional thing here. I'm actually going to make a couple of additional approximations so we can actually compute these four-point functions. I'm going to ignore the fluctuations of this field phi and of gravity. Okay? So I have some situation now where the background is literally just the De Sitter space. But I still have these multiple vacua. The instantons exist. You can still make transitions between these vacua, but I'm going to ignore dynamical gravity and also the fluctuations of the phi field. Okay? So There's at the end, we're going to come back, there's a lot of things that are going to need to be added back in before this can be taken seriously as a model of eternal inflation. The goal here is to start with the simplest possible thing where you can compute something and see what that thing looks like. So,
when you say,
yes, now I'm going to focus on this.
Yeah. So when you say you ignore fluctuations, the way that I would interpret it is homogeneous, but that's not what you're meaning.
I'm going to focus in just on the instantons, which make the transition from here to here. So in terms of the field.
Somehow they change. Why aren't they fluctuations?
I'm going to ignore the perturbative. I'm going to ignore the perturbative fluctuations. So if you like, you can think of this as taking some limit where the mass in each of these minima is quite large, but the tunneling rate stays fine. Okay? This is certainly something which should be added back in. But all right, this is a hard problem. So okay, now I'm going to focus on the solution which has the SO4-1 symmetry. So the geometry is pure De Sitter space. That's the solution I'm going to focus on because, well, we normally focus on the maximally symmetric thing, and it's only going to change the results in infrared if I change that. So here's what happens. Let's say I take some initial condition that I started out. So before we include the instantons, we just have the center space here. Let's take an initial condition here that we started all in one vector. Since I'm ignoring the perturbative fluctuations here, I'm just going to label these by an integer. So these vacua are just going to label by an integer. And let's just say I started out in the vacuum with n equals 0 on this initial condition surface. It's going to turn out that which initial condition surface I choose is not going to matter, and we can, in fact, completely take it away without affecting the computation. But it's easier to think about if we start with some initial condition surface. Now, from time to time, some bubbles can nucleate. Okay, there's two different things that can happen. If you start here, you can tunnel to the right, or you can tunnel to the left. Okay, so if you tunnel to the right, inside here, you get some kind of vacuum where n equals 1. Now, on the other hand, you can tunnel to the left, and there you get n equals minus 1. And then within that thing, you can tunnel to the right, or you can tunnel to the left. And if you tunnel to the right, if you tunnel to the left, you have 10 equals minus 2. That is the dynamics of this model.
Then,
yes.
Why is it SO4 1 invariant? I mean, I would say that this is just SO4.
Because of the initial condition. That's right. So now it turns out that the quantities, which will be well defined, are actually insensitive to whether I put this cutoff in. Or I can actually add, so I can actually add instantons, which nucleate down here. Those are going to be perfectly fine in this theory. And so for that reason, it doesn't really matter where this initial condition surface is. Okay, so since I do this, so you can draw some instantons that look like that. It doesn't matter. Okay. So, right. So the reason I wanted to right now explain the system is I wanted to explain that this is dual to a very simple statistical mechanics. I mean, you can see that these bubbles nucleate. What do they form? They form some kind of form some kind of balls on the boundary where n takes different values. Okay. So picture of the boundary. I can think of the boundary being a plane. Okay. And I'm going to focus on two boundary dimensions because we like to analyze CFTs in two dimensions. Okay, we have more tools there, so this has more ways to go wrong. So I'm going to focus on two boundary dimensions, but most of these computations will apply in any number of boundary dimensions. So what this dynamics looks like is that, okay, out here we have n equals 0, and then inside here we have some kind of bubble which looks like n equals 1. Here's a bigger one, which has n equals minus 1. Okay, and here's a bubble with n equals minus 2. And once I've included all of these bubbles, you know, this n equals 0 is going to be completely eaten up. And so you're not going to, the thing is not going to be sensitive to the initial conditions. Okay, so I've lost the erase in here.
It's on the middle.
Ah, right. Okay. So the reason that I wanted to go into this amount of detail right now before getting into a complication is to just say that this is dual to a simple but non-trivial statistical system.
And this isn't the ground state of the system.
Well, the correlation functions I compute will have the SO41 symmetry.
And so I think that means that they're the ground state. I might have been a bit.
I would have thought the ground state, you take equal amplitude for all, then of course we'll take equal momentum in the 5, right? So then you start there and we get a superposition of everyone. So all you get
dealt with is a superposition of different exact sitters.
I
mean, a bunch of sitters with different
bars. No, but sorry. I mean, instantons can still happen. I mean, so it's true that if you want the right initial condition here, it's not really n equals 0. It's really a quantum superposition of every location here.
Right.
Okay. In this theory, because there's this shift symmetry, phi or the value of n is not really a physical field. Okay?
Right.
So probably it is correct to say that the right ground state is a superposition.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but the observable quantities are things like derivatives of n, spatial derivatives of n. Okay, and so that's why I'm free to just choose one and say I started there. But perhaps I've been a little bit crude in describing this.
If you go up to that future boundary, the state you end up in is a superposition. It's a combination of what happens after there have been an infinite number of instanton transitions in all directions. So there's an equilibrium state, which is evenly spread throughout this thing, and that's exactly what's going to come out.
But why can't you just regard that as an exact sitter, just the exact sitter in its ground state?
Don, the point is, you can start in the superposition. There's still a local process where you jump to the right.
Yeah, but I mean, isn't it like the k-dot system? If you take, you could use one representation where they oscillate, or well, it's ignoring the k's. You could just go to the mass eigenstates, and then there's.
That's not. We're talking about an oscillative effect where the thing hops to the right. This is a physical effect which can happen, whether no matter what state you're in, and it's a local effect.
Are you thinking of phi as a model of some? This is a model of some landscape potential.
Yes.
So physically, there would be things that other macroscopic things which depend on phi, and then each.
But that's not the model I'm considering. I'm considering a very simple model which has a shift symmetry.
See, if nothing depends on phi, I don't see why you couldn't just take start off with the superposition of all of them equal. It's just a pure, exactly the sitter in their instance.
The point is that there's a physical quantity which you want to compute, which is like, say, derivatives of n or correlation functions of n. Okay?
But if you really have the symmetry, the n should be completely unobservable. I mean, it should just be.
But correlation functions of derivatives are observable.
Okay.
N is unobservable, and it doesn't matter what initial condition you choose. If you can completely remove it, there's an equilibrium configuration which is more or less like what you're saying, and it's gonna you'll see. I mean, when you compute these correlators, they don't depend on N, and they don't depend on the initial condition.
Okay.
So you can completely take it away, and it's just a thermal state with a potential like that. So it finds some density matrix which is spread throughout these things, and the well-defined quantities are correlation functions of, for example, derivatives of n or exponentials of n, but things that don't depend on n itself.
Okay.
All right. Maybe I should continue here. Yes?
Are you assuming that the CFT is unitary or you're not assuming that?
No.
Okay. Then it's not the case that the SO41 symmetric state is necessarily the lowest state.
Okay.
That only follows in unitary CFT.
Okay. Well, all right, so this is dual to a simple statistical system, which is a scale invariant distribution. In two dimensions, this. Okay, so the statistical system looks like some sort of thing like this, where you have these different disks. And the reason I'm emphasizing this system is that it's a rather simple system where you can compute things explicitly, and I'm hoping that it'll have some application to percolation or something like that. So let me tell you what the partition function is. The partition function.
So what do you mean by scaling gravity?
I'm about to write the partition function. The partition function is a sum over the number of disks, which the number of instantons which move you to the right. Okay. There's a dimensionless quantity, which is the tunneling rate in Hubble units in the ball. So if you want to have n disks, you pay a price of tunneling rate for the n. Each disk you can put down its center at any location. And you can choose its size to be anything you want. And there's a scale of varying distribution of sizes. Okay? So the tunneling rate is a product of the right moving piece times same thing, the left moving piece. Okay? And since these vacua are all identical, by detailed balance, these gamma plus is going to equal gamma minus. So there's really just one free parameter here. And so this is what I mean by a scalar invariant distribution. I'm leaving out something here. There's n disks here. I get to integrate separately over each the size and the location of the center and the size of each disk. And so so that looks like this. Sorry, kidding. N. Okay, so that's what the partition function is, and you can see that this is an exponential. So actually, the partition function is just e to the gamma integral dr over rq integral.
Where does the factor?
Where that's the location of the center of the disk.
Where does the factor r to the minus c come from?
Okay. So I'm about to explain that from the ball.
This is like a dilute gas of instantons here, assuming.
Well, that's right. So I should say that in order to write down this simple partition function, we've made a few other simplifying assumptions, which I had planned to discuss. But basically I'm ignoring interactions between the different instantons in order to say that it takes this.
Exactly. There's no problem with instantons tending to get large.
Well, there are very large instantons, but you'll see that the physical quantities are finite, are infrared finite. So that is an important physical point here. I mean, there are infrared fluctuations like this sort of bubble down here. There's a divergent number of them, and if we hadn't been careful to make a simple model where you have this shift symmetry and so on, then we had to be careful in defining our physical quantities so that they were infrared safe. Okay, and that's why, I'm sorry for showing confusion about the initial conditions, but that's why I could afford to be sloppy about the initial conditions, because infrared fluctuations wash those away.
If these walls are heavy, I mean, you cannot get rid of initial conditions. But then you have a collection phase where you generate infinite number of those bubbles. If they have some mass,
That's right.
Contracts, you have a disaster.
That's right. But I've turned gravity off, so in this model I can't.
Okay.
But you're right. In a more realistic situation, you wouldn't be able to do this. Okay. So, good. So, that's the end of the introduction. So, here's the outline. First, I'm going to describe, well, whatever. Okay. First, I'm going to describe this model. I'm going to derive the z from the ball. Okay. Now I was going to compute the two-point function because the computations in this theory they're elementary, but they're not particularly easy, and they're sort of unusual. So I wanted to show them to you, but I think you've succeeded in escaping that. So I probably won't actually compute this. Okay, and then I'll talk about the 3 and 4 point functions. And then I'll talk about some future possibilities. Now, what's going to happen here is that we can compute the 4 point function analytically using elementary techniques. Okay, so let me just give you the brief summary, okay? The 2 and 3 point functions have exactly the form that you would expect for a CFT, okay? That's determined by conformal invariance. The 4 point function is conformally invariant. It's kind of an unusual theory in that we can compute it explicitly using elementary, you know, geometric techniques. Okay, but the 4 point function doesn't have all of the features you would expect it to have in a healthy field theory. In particular, the 4 point function has a disease, which I'll describe. So this thing is not quite an honest CFT. And there's two particular directions I'm hoping to go in here. One is this CFT, or this not quite CFT, as the first step in the fabulous dual CFT, which Jama and Alex have been thinking about. The other direction is this not quite CFT should be useful for something. It should be the limit of perhaps some percolation model, some type of model where you can't compute things explicitly, but where the 4 point function is well behaved. Okay, so I think there should really be some application for this thing beyond quantum gravity, because everybody here can see that in order to describe eternal inflation, we're going to have to add a lot more features. But there may be other statistical systems to which this is a much closer approximation, and I'm hoping that it will be useful in that way. Okay. So, all right, so first let me tell you why the partition function has this form, as Robert was asking. So I want to think about this field theory living on the plane, okay? So I'm just going to use coordinates in the center space. So here's the center space. Here's minus infinity in the flat slicing, and I'm going to use this slicing, okay? In the end, it's going to be conformally invariant, so I can think of the boundary as being a plane or a sphere or whatever. And the metric looks like this. Okay? And the boundary is at A equals 0.
And I'm going to focus on 3 bulk dimensions. Okay, the tunneling rate, so the rate at producing bubbles, is this dimensionless quantity gamma times the 4 volume in Hubble units. Okay, and let's see, perhaps there should be some Hubble here. Let me set Hubble to 1. So this thing. 1. Okay, so we can write down, I'm sorry, I'm in D equals 3, so this is a free volume. Okay. All right, I'm focusing on 3 bulk dimensions, but this computation goes through in exactly the same way. All right, so the number of bubbles, you can write down the volume element, so it has this 1 over eta cubed, and then it has d eta. And then it has d2x. All right, that's the distribution. That's the rate of producing bubbles. And now, how big do those bubbles look? Space-time. Now, the size on future infinity is related to the conformal time eta at which this thing nucleates. You can see that light rays satisfy d eta equals dx. So if this thing nucleates at some time eta, the size on the boundary is equal to the conformal time at which it nucleates. The conformal time is conventionally negative down here, so I'll put in an absolute value sign. Okay, so I can rewrite R as eta, and that's where you get this distribution of bubbles here. This is where you get this conformally invariant distribution from. Okay? So there's the partition function. Okay. So now let's go ahead and compute the two-point function, or just tell you what the two-point function is. So what are the healthy operators to compute in this theory? As we discussed earlier, I guess I was planning to postpone that discussion, but as we discussed earlier, n itself, where did n go? Ah, okay. N itself is not really physical here because of the shift symmetry. So things like derivatives of n are physical quantities. The thing which behaves more nicely under conformal transformations are actually exponentials. So the natural thing to define is something which will be very familiar to string theorists, which is these vertex operator type things. And so what this operator is e to the I beta times n of z. Okay? These are the things which have well-behaved correlation functions. And So z is the location in the plane. So I can put z in z bar. But let me just write z. Okay? So this is some measure of the number of bubbles at that point. And these are the correlation functions which have definite conformal dimension. And they have all the information in them about correlation functions of n. But since n itself is not physical, it's a bit awkward to write down the correlation functions of n itself. So these are the natural things to focus on. So now, suppose you could compute the two-point function. Okay? So what we're going to compute is the expectation value of e to the I beta 1 at one point. With e to the I beta 2 at another point. Okay? So we need to plug this into this partition function here. And what this let me skip the details of the computation and just say that there's a rather simple formula for this. I'm going to show basically one step in this computation here. So what this ends up being equal to is e to the minus gamma 1, minus cosine beta 1 times this. So this thing again exponentiates. And you get some kind of contribution like this. And now there's the theta function because I'm only including some of the bubbles. Only the bubbles which cover either z1 or z2 contribute to this correlation function. Okay? So I get a factor like this. The disks which cover only point z1 contribute here. So the disks which have radius bigger than, so x is the location of the disk. So the disks which have radius bigger than their distance from z1, get to contribute to this quantity. The ones which with 1 minus cosine beta, and then they have the opposite theta function. So if they're going to contribute with just the beta 1 here, then they should cover z1 but not z2. Okay? So this product of theta functions is just telling you that in this particular term, you should only include the disks which cover the point z1, but not the point z2. Okay? There's another term where everything is the same except beta 1 becomes beta 2, And this this Z1 becomes Z2, and this Z2 becomes Z1. And then there's another term, which is also multiplied, which comes from disks covering both points. Okay. So there we have a beta 1 plus beta 2. And the reason I'm dragging you through this is because this term is the most interesting one. So this thing should cover both points. So we should have this combination of theta functions. Okay, so what you end up computing here is some kind of, so you can see you're integrating over disks of different sizes. And so what you end up computing is things like the integral dr over r cubed times this integral d2x. It's the integral over the location of the center. And so, for example, this last term, we have this integral over the scale invariant distribution of disks, and then we have to integrate over where their centers can be such that they cover both points. If we have Z1 here and Z2 here, you can draw a disk for some given R. You can draw a disk of radius R around each point, and then if the center is in here, it will contribute, if a disk whose center is in here will cover both of these points. And so it will contribute here. And so you need to compute integrals of geometric quantities like this. So it's sort of an unusual kind of computation, which is not necessarily all that easy once you get to higher point functions, but it is very simple. Okay. So that's the type of computation. And the reason I wanted to focus on this term is that when the radius gets very large, the area of overlap of this becomes actually nearly the whole thing. So this overlap area, which is a function of R and Z1 and Z2, approaches pi R squared as R goes to infinity compared to the separation. Okay? So you can see that this integral is actually divergent at large R. Okay? And so what that means is that this term here, because this integral is divergent at large R. And so this term is in danger of making the whole correlation function zero. Okay? So what you find is that the correlation function is equal to zero as you take the infrared cutoff away, unless this quantity is zero here, which multiplies this divergent integral. So unless cosine of beta 1 plus beta 2 is equal to 1, okay, which means that beta 1 plus beta 2 equals 2 pi times an integer. Yes.
Divergence appears in Young-Wills theories. Mm-hmm. If you just take bosonic Young-Wills and do instantons, you'll get the integral dr by r to the phi. And there one says that what this means is that this dilute gas of instantons is nonsense to something else.
Well, what I'm going to say here is something different, actually. What I'm going to say here is that we have this shift symmetry. Remember, n goes to n plus 1. Okay? So if you want, there's kind of a conserved charge under that shift symmetry. Well, let me just say it more explicitly. Here's a correlation function. How does that transform under the shift symmetry? Okay? Under n goes to n plus 1, this correlation function I just wrote down here goes to e to the I beta 1 plus beta 2 times itself. Okay? This thing is a symmetry of the theory, so the correlation functions have to be invariant.
Therefore, unless this thing is equal to unity, okay, so this means that this correlation function equals zero unless e to the I beta 1 plus beta 2 is equal to 1. Okay, so basically this correlation function is only a physical quantity. Well, maybe that's the wrong way of saying it. This correlation function has to be zero unless it's invariant under this symmetry. And so that's what's going on here. And if you wanted some kind of charge conservation condition, you have the shift symmetry n goes to n plus 1. Okay, beta is the charge under that shift symmetry. So saying that beta 1 plus beta 2 equals 0 is saying that this thing overall has charge 0. All right, and because it's only a discrete shift symmetry, you end up with this kind of novel effect that the charge is only defined mod 2 pi. Okay, so that's all right. So that's kind of a fun feature of these correlation functions. And now, in the case where beta 1 plus beta 2 is equal to an integer, so maybe this. You go here. All right, so you do this kind of geometric integral. So the other integrals are all finite. All right, and right. So if it is an integer, then this correlation function is just equal to the UV cutoff divided by the distance between the points to the power pi gamma 1 minus cosine beta. Okay, so when these things add up to an integer, their cosines are equal, so there's only one beta. Beta 1 equals beta 2 mod 2 pi. And so this is what the two-point function looks like. So this is exactly the two-point function for a conformal field with dimension delta equals delta bar equals pi gamma, I think maybe there's some 2 here, times 1 minus cosine beta. Okay? So this is a rather unusual formula here. In the more familiar case, in string theory or something, the dimension of this thing would not have this complicated form. You would get something like just k squared over here. And so this is a nice formula for the dimension. Okay, so the two-point function looks exactly like the two-point function for a CFT should. Yes?
You still have operators with scaling dimensions a little bit above zero?
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, so in fact, this well, it's in our paper, but this exact, you can actually just do this computation in more dimensions, and you get the same thing. And so it's not exotic in two dimensions to have scaling dimensions near zero, but it is exotic in more dimensions. And so, okay, that's...
What's delta in this formula?
Delta is a conformal dimension.
The little delta.
Ah, sorry, yeah, good. So this thing is the UV cutoff. And this is the natural dependence of a two-point function on the UV cutoff. Okay, it's just there by dimensional analysis. Okay, so that's what the two-point function looks like. The three-point function also has the standard form. Again, there's this charge conservation, and I'm not even going to write down the three-point function in view of the time, but the three-point function has the standard form. Determined by conformal invariants. So far everything looks like a real on a CFT. All right, so the three-point function is standard. All right, so now what about the four-point function? You know, I should say that the fact that these things are conformally invariant, in a way it's trivial because the bulk geometry has this SO41 symmetry, which becomes the conformal symmetry. The trick is trying to find quantities which are not infrared sensitive and which remain finite when you take the initial condition surface away. And that's what we've managed to do here. That's why you have these nice formulas. So really the whole, you know, once you have something which doesn't depend on the infrared cutoff,
it's more or less guaranteed that it's going to have this nice form. I mean, we've gone to the additional step of finding things with definite conformal dimensions, so we've kind of diagonalized the dilatation group. But the whole game here is getting rid of infrared divergences, which is equivalent to asking to be able to take the initial condition surface away. And that's going to be a crucial thing which could become more complicated in a more realistic model. All right. So what does the four-point function look like? So the traditional thing that CFT people want to know about the four-point function, you can go ahead and use conformal invariance. I mean, it is conformally invariant to put the points in this configuration. So you have a point out at infinity, a point at 0, a point at 1, and a point at z. And you can compute the four-point function, so e to the I beta 1 n of z1, e to the I beta 2 n of 0, e to the I beta 3 n of 1, e to the I beta 4 n of infinity. Okay? This is the thing that people like to compute. And it's equal to some constant, which actually becomes infinite as you take this thing to infinity. It's equal to some delta function of charge conservation, just like before. And then the crucial issue is the dependence on z, okay? And so what this thing looks like is it has a prefactor, which is not particularly, which has, you know, the standard form which it's supposed to have. I can define what this delta 1, 2 is, but it's the dimension of the operator that beta 1 and that delta 1 and delta 2 fuse to become. But this prefactor isn't really the point. So we have some kind of polynomial prefactor, which is totally standard. And then we have the non-trivial part of the two-point function. So it's e to some constant, which depends on the dimensions. Okay, it's some polynomial function of the dimensions of the operators. And then the sine of the imaginary part of z. And then the imaginary part of log z log 1 minus z bar. And then this Bloch-Wigner function of z, which is essentially the polylogarithm function. So this d2 of z is the Bloch-Wigner function. And I was going to say a little bit more about it, but all we really need to know for this purpose is that it's real analytic away from z equals 0 and 1. So that's a real analytic function. Now, this correlator gets a lot of things right. It has to be symmetric under various symmetries, like z goes to 1 over 1 minus z, which relate to permuting these four points. And it gets all of that right. Here's the thing that it gets wrong, which makes it not a conventional CFT. As you take this point z and you move it across the real axis here, this thing is all a real analytic function. It's not totally obvious because it has this disgusting imaginary, et cetera. But this is a real analytic function away from z equals 0 and z equals 1, whereas the sine of the imaginary part of z is clearly not real analytic. Okay? So there's a non-analyticity in the four-point function as we drag this point across the real axis. Okay? So, and this is not something which would happen in a conventional local field theory, much less a CFT. All right? There's a non-analyticity. Some fifth derivative or something diverges at that point. Okay? So, do I have about 3 minutes to conclude here? I mean, I only started at 9:06. Yeah, and I Well, I suppose people are getting me back for asking a lot of questions during their talks. Okay, fine, 2 minutes. Okay. All right. So here's the thing. I think this is a very interesting system. I don't know quite what to do with it. Okay? There's one obvious direction to start putting in more effects to try to make this a model of eternal inflation. There should also be another direction to relate this to some condensed matter system or something which people care about. It's some kind of system where you can compute things. There's a non-trivial four-point function. It's not quite a CFT. Okay? So one question is, one direction is what to do to make it a CFT. And let me just mention a couple of the most obvious things. You should include fluctuations in the shapes of the bubbles. Okay, the fact that this is non-analytic is probably related to the rigidity of these disks, and if we integrated over different shapes, that would probably be eliminated. And the other thing that really should be included, you should probably include the perturbative fluctuations in the field and in gravity. Okay, as Simeon has pointed out, you can't just take any theory in De Sitter space and expect it to be dual to a real CFT. That theory better at least have gravity. And probably once you want it to be a real CFT, it better be really a quantum theory of gravity. But certainly the most urgent thing is to start including the perturbative fluctuations of the field phi and also the graviton. Okay? But I do think that this is an interesting model to start thinking about what a dual theory for eternal inflation would look like, what questions it would answer for us, what would be the right quantities, which are well defined in that theory. And I'm hoping over the next few days to hear from you about what direction it might be fruitful to push this in. Thank you.
So we have time for an urgent question.
I'm all urgent questions. I'm not sure if it's an urgent question, but just a technical comment. So your discontinuity is related to the fact that you're using triangles and you made that the sign that when z goes through the axis, that the area of a triangle.
Well, it's not exactly triangles. I mean, but yeah, it's related to these disks. I mean, these integrals, these integrals, you're computing kind of the four volume available for covering some number of disks.
And that's the discontinuity that has a discontinuity when you squeeze.
That's right. I mean, a simple model would be something like you have a plane and you have a point here and a point there, and you're computing the area of the, you're computing cross product. But you want to compute the area, so there's an absolute value.
Right. So it makes sense to actually include the sign so that the absolute.
Well, yeah. So that was what exactly. So right. That's what's happening. You could just eliminate this. Yeah. Then it would try to become negative. But then, there's negative volumes available. I don't know. So maybe there's some modification. I mean, that's really what that function wants to do. And so maybe there's some modification to the theory that makes it do that.
Okay, great. Well, I'm sure that then we'll take questions during coffee. And we'll resume at 10:35.